72 looked faintly annoyed, but Lyra knew he was probably just jealous because he didn't yet have a name.
"Wow," Jake said, "and I thought being named after my father was bad.
Sorry," he added quickly.
"Dumb joke. Just stay here, okay? We'll be back in 10 minutes.
For a while, 72 and Lyra sat in silence. Lyra figured out how to roll down the window but found no relief from the heat outside. It was what Nurse Don't Even Think About It had called molasses hot. She watched Jake and Gemma as they narrowed into brush strokes and then disappeared into W-A-L-M-A-R-T. Gemma's reference to her grandmother bothered her, but it excited her too because of what it meant. Finally, she said, "I don't think the girl knows she's a replica." 72 had been staring out the window, fists lodged in his armpits, hunched over as though he were cold, which was impossible. He turned to her.
"What?"
"The girl's a replica, but I don't think she knows it." The idea was taking shape now, and with it the simple suggestion of possibility, of a life that might exist on the other side of Haven. At the same time, she was afraid to voice the possibility out loud, aware that it would sound silly, and afraid of what 72 would say. Which means, well, maybe she comes from a place where being a replica doesn't make a difference. Where they have families and drive cars and things like that. Lyra could see herself reflected in 72's eyes. They were the color of the maple syrup served in the stew pot on special occasions like Christmas and the anniversary of the first god's death.
"Is that what you want?"
he said at last.
"You want a family?"
"I don't know." Lyra turned away from him, embarrassed by the intensity of his stare, which felt like being back in the box, like being evaluated, having her eyes and knees tested for reflexes. Her idea of mother looked much like the nurses and the Haven staff. Mother was someone to feed and clothe you and make sure you took your medicines, but now, unbidden, an image of Dr. O'Donnell came to her. She imagined herself tucked up in a big white bed while Dr. O'Donnell read out loud. She remembered the way that Dr. O'Donnell's hands had smelled and the feel of fingertips skimming the crown of her head. "Good night, Lyra." And there were her dreams, too. Impressions of a birther who held and rocked her, and a cup with lions around its rim. When she was younger, she had searched the mess hall for such a cup before being forced to admit that all the glasses at Haven were plain, made of clear plastic. She knew her dreams must be just that. Dreams, a kind of wishful thinking. But she was too ashamed to confess what she was thinking. That she could find Dr. O'Donnell, that Dr. O'Donnell could be her mother. "What do you want?" Lyra asked instead, turning to 72. "You ran away, even if you didn't get far."
"I couldn't," 72 said. "I couldn't figure out a way past the guards."
"You must have been hoping that something like this would happen," Lyra said, and a suspicion flickered. Could 72 have somehow been responsible for the disaster at Haven? But no, that didn't make any sense. They were standing together when the explosion happened. They were touching. 72 frowned as if he knew what she was thinking.
"I didn't hope for anything," he said. "I was just waiting for my chance."
"But you must have had a plan," she insisted. "You must have had an idea of where you would go on the other side."
"I didn't have a plan."
He leaned back, closing his eyes. As soon as he did, he once again looked much younger. Or not younger, exactly, stripped down somehow, naked. Lyra remembered that once she and Ursa Major and Cassiopeia had spied on the male's dormitory from the courtyard. Through a partially open blind, they'd seen the blurry and bony silhouette of one of the males shirtless, and they'd stumbled backward, shocked and gasping, when he turned in their direction. Looking at 72 gave Lyra the same feeling of peering through those blinds and left her excited and also terrified. She was almost relieved when he opened his eyes again.
"You asked me what I want. I'll tell you what I don't want. I don't want to spend the rest of my life being told what to do, and what to eat, and when to sleep, and when to use the bathroom. I'm tired of being a lab rat.
What do you mean, a lab rat?
It was so hot, Lyra was having trouble thinking. Once or twice she'd been sent into B-Wing for some reason or another, and seen the milk-white rats in their cages, had seen when they threaded their paws through the bars the elongated pinkness of their strangely human fingers, and some of them were suffering in some stage of an experiment, bloated with pain or covered in dozens of tumorous growths, so heavy they couldn't lift their heads.
I watched, he said simply. I paid attention.
He turned his face to the window. When I was little, I didn't know the difference. I thought I might be an animal. I thought I must be.
Lyra had an uncomfortable memory again, of number 35 crawling on all fours, insisting on eating her dinner from a bowl on the ground. But number 35 had been soft in the brain, everyone said so.
"Aren't you worried about what will happen?" she asked. "Without medicine, without check-ins, with no one to help us when we get sick? We weren't made for the outside." But even as she said it, Lyra thought again of Dr. O'Donnell. She knew how the replicas were built. She was a doctor, and she'd worked at Haven. She could help.
"You really believe?"
It wasn't a question. He had turned back to her.
"You believe everything they ever told you."
"What do you mean?" she asked. It was so hot. Her face was hot. He was looking at her like some of the nurses did, like she wasn't exactly real, like he was struggling to see her. But before he could answer, Jake was back, sliding behind the wheel.
"Sorry," he said. "Forgot to leave the AC on. I realize you guys must be baking. Hot as balls today, isn't it?"
72 was still watching Lyra. But then he turned back toward the window.
"Yes," he said.
It was the first time he'd spoken directly to one of the humans except in anger, and Lyra noticed that Jake startled in his seat, as if he hadn't really expected a reply.
"Hot."
Lyra. Chapter 10. Lyra had never seen so many houses or imagined that there could be so many people in the world. She knew the facts. She'd heard the nurses and doctors discussing them sometimes, problems with overpopulation, the division between rich and poor, and the nurses often watched TV or listened to the radio or watched videos on their phones when they were bored. But knowing something was different from seeing it. House upon house, many of them identical, so she felt dizzyingly as if she were going forward and also turning a circle. Car after car lined up along the streets, grass trim and vividly green, and people everywhere. People driving or out on their lawns or waiting in groups on corners for reasons she couldn't fathom. Jake stopped again at one of these houses and Gemma got out of the car. Lyra watched through the window as a girl with black hair emerged from the house and barreled into Gemma's arms. Lyra was confused by this, as she was by Jake and Gemma's relationship, the casual way they spoke to each other, and the fact that Gemma was a replica but didn't know it. But she was confused by so much she didn't have the energy to worry about it. For several minutes, Gemma and the other girls stood outside. Lyra tried to determine whether this second girl, the black-haired one, was a replica or a regular human, but couldn't tell. Although she was wearing human clothes and her hair was long, she used her hands a lot. Then the girl went inside and Gemma returned to the car alone. "April's going to open the gate," she told Jake. She sounded breathless, though she hadn't walked far. "You can park next to the pool house." Jake advanced the car and they corkscrewed left behind the house. Lyra saw a dazzling rectangle of water, still as a bath, which she knew must be a pool. Even though she couldn't swim, she had the urge to go under, to wash away what felt like days of accumulated dirt and mud and sweat. There were bathtubs in postnatal, and even though they were too small to lie down in, Lyra had sometimes filled a tub and stepped into her ankles after it was her turn to tickle, engage, and maintain physical contact with the new replicas. When the gate closed behind them with a loud clang, Lyra truly felt safe for the first time since leaving Haven. Contained, controlled, protected.
Next to the pool was a miniature version of the big house. Sliding doors opened into a large, carpeted room that was dark and deliciously cold. The house was mostly white, which Lyra liked. It was like being back in Haven. Goosebumps ran along Lyra's arm as if someone had just touched her. Where the carpet ran out was a kitchen alcove that Lyra identified only by its stove. It looked nothing like the kitchen and stew pot. A vast and shiny space filled with the hiss of steam from industrial dishwashers. Through an open door she saw a large bed, also made up with a white sheet and blankets and so many pillows she couldn't imagine what they were all for. And lined up on bookshelves next to the sofa, books. Dozens of books. 4 times as many as she'd seen in the nurse's break room, so many that in her excitement the titles blended together and she couldn't make out a single one. She wanted to touch them. Their spines looked like different colored candies the nurses exchanged sometimes, like the sugared lozenges the replicas got sometimes when they had coughs. But she was almost afraid to, afraid that if she did, they would all blow apart. She wondered how long it would take her to read every book on the shelves. Months? Years, even? Maybe they would be allowed to stay here, in this clean and pretty room, with the sun that patterned the carpet and the soft hum of hidden air conditioning. At WALMART, Gemma had bought Lyra and 72 new clothes. Nothing fancy, and I had to guess how they would fit. Soap, shampoo, toothbrushes and toothpaste and more food, including cereal and milk, granola bars, cans of soup. She said she could show them how to heat in the microwave, and at least a dozen frozen meals. She showed them where the shower was, a single shower stall, the first Lyra had ever seen, and apologized that there was only one bed. "So, you know, you'll have to share, unless one of you wants to take the sofa," she said. Lyra felt suddenly uncomfortable, remembering Pepper and her unborn baby and how she'd been found with her wrists open. The Christmas parties when the doctors got drunk and sometimes visited the dorms late at night, staggering on their feet and smelling sharply of alcohol swabs. That was why it was better for males and females to stay apart. "I know you must be exhausted, so we're going to leave you alone for a bit, okay? Just don't go anywhere." Lyra didn't bother pointing out that they had nowhere to go. "Get some sleep," Gemma said. The more Lyra looked at her, the less she resembled Cassiopeia and her other genotypes. That was the funny thing about genotypes, something the nurses and doctors who could never tell them apart had never understood. If you looked, you could see differences in the way they moved and spoke and used their hands. Over time, their personalities changed even the way that they looked. And of course, Gemma was much heavier than Cassiopeia and had long hair to her shoulders that looked soft to the touch. Gemma was nicer than Cassiopeia, more prone to worry, too. But they had the same stubbornness. That Lyra could see, too. As soon as they were alone, Lyra went to the bookshelves. She could feel 72 watching her, but she didn't care and couldn't resist any longer. She reached up and ran a finger along the spines, each of them textured differently. Some of them gloss, smooth and hard, and others soft and crumbly like dirt. L-I-T-T-L-E. W-O-M-E-N. Little Women. T-H-E-G-O-L-D-C-O-A-S-T. When she thought of the little prince, lost somewhere on the marshes, she still felt like crying. But these books made up for it, at least a little.
"You were telling the truth,"
72 said. He was watching her closely.
"You can read."
He made it sound like a bad thing. "I told you. Dr. O'Donnell taught me." She kept skipping her fingers over the titles and, as she did, read out loud. "The Old Man and the Sea. The Long Walk. The Hunger Games." He came to stand next to her. Again she could smell him, an earthy sweetness that made her feel slightly dizzy. She'd never found out which of the males Pepper had been with, although Cassiopeia had said a male doctor because of what happened at the Christmas party, because Pepper had been chosen. But she wondered now, whether instead it was 72.
Is it hard?
He asked. At the beginning, she said. She didn't know why she was thinking of Pepper. She took a step away from 72. Not so much when you get the hang of it.
I thought only people could read,
he blurted out. When she turned to look at him, surprised by the tone of his voice, he turned away.
I'm going to get clean.
A moment later, she heard the shower pipes shudder and the water start in the bathroom, a familiar sound that lulled her once again into exhaustion. She didn't understand 72 and his rapid changes of mood, but he'd chosen to stay with her. He hadn't left her behind. Maybe this complexity was a feature of the male replicas. She didn't know, had never been allowed to interact with them. She removed the file she'd taken from its filthy pillowcase and placed it carefully on the desk below the windows. Although she had a room full of books now, a room full of books, an idea so exciting it made goosebumps on her arms again. The folder, and the single sheet of paper it contained, was her final tether to home. She recognized an old patient report. She'd seen enough of her own reports to recognize a version of the form still in use. But she was too tired to read, and she left the folder open on the desk and returned to the shelves, no longer trying to make sense of the words, just admiring the way the letters looked, the angles and curls and scrolled loops of them.
I'm all done now.
She hadn't heard the shower go off or 72 emerge from the bathroom. She turned and froze. His skin, which had been streaked with blood and caked in a layer of sediment and crusted mud, was now as shiny and polished as a beach stone and the color of new wood. His eyelashes, grayed by the ash, were long and black. A towel was wrapped around his waist. She was struck again by the strangeness of the male's body, the broadness of his shoulders and the torqued narrowness of his muscled waist. Thank you, she said, snatching up the clothes Gemma had left for her. She was careful not to pass too close to him when she moved into the bathroom. She shut the door firmly, a little confused by the mechanism of the lock. At Haven, all the doors locked with keypads or codes, except for the bathrooms, which had no locks at all. She stripped down and balled her filthy clothes in a corner. She had never showered alone before, and it felt wonderful. The big, echoey bathroom, the space, the aloneness of it. Was this how all people lived? It felt luxurious to her. She spent a few minutes adjusting the taps, delighted by how quickly the water responded. In Haven there was never enough hot water. The soap Gemma had bought was lilac-scented and pale purple, and Lyra found herself thinking of 72, naked, washing with purple soap. And the urge to giggle bubbled up in her chest, followed by a wave of dizziness. She had to sit with her head between her legs and the water driving down on her shoulders until it passed. She lathered and rinsed her scalp, scrubbed her ears with a pinky finger, washed the soles of her feet so that they became so slippery it was treacherous to stand. Finally, she felt clean. Even the towels here were better than they were at Haven, where they were thin and stiff from hundreds of washings. Her new clothes felt soft and clean. Gemma had bought her cotton underwear in different colors. She never had underwear that was anything but a bleached, dingy beige. Looking at herself in the mirror, she almost could have passed for a real person, except for the length of her hair. She fingered the scar above her right eyebrow. She had scars all over her body now, from spinal taps and harvesting operations to test her blood marrow. But when she was dressed, most of them were concealed. Not this one, though. In the bedroom, she found 72 stretched out on top of the covers, staring up at the ceiling fan. He was wearing new jeans that Gemma had bought for him, and this fact seemed only to emphasize his shirtlessness and the smooth, muscled lines of his chest and shoulders. She'd never noticed how beautiful bodies could be. She thought of them only as parts, machine components that serviced a whole. She'd been interested in the males, of course, curious about them, but she'd also learned that curiosity led to disappointment, that it was better not to want,
not to look, not to wonder. But she was suddenly terrified of lying next to him, although she couldn't have said exactly why. Maybe because of what had happened to Pepper. But she thought it was more than that.
What?
72 sat up on his elbows.
Why are you looking at me like that?
There's no reason. Realizing she'd been staring, she forced herself to move to the bed. She slipped under the sheets, these two softer than any she'd ever known, and curled up with her knees to her chest, as far from 72 as possible. But still, her heart was beating fast. She felt, or imagined she felt, warmth radiating off him. He smelled now a different kind of sweet, like shampoo and soap and fresh scrubbed skin. For a long time they lay there together, and she couldn't stop seeing him next to her, couldn't stop seeing his lashes lying on his cheeks when he closed his eyes, and the high planes of his cheekbones and the darkness of his eyes. He shifted in the bed. He put a hand on her waist. His hand was hot, burning hot. "Lyra," he whispered. His breath felt very close to her ear. She was terrified to move, terrified to turn and see how close he was.
"What?"
she whispered back.
"I like your name,"
he said.
"I wanted to say your name."
Then the bed shifted again, and she knew he'd rolled over to go to sleep. Finally, after a long time, the tension in her body relaxed, and she slept, too. When she woke up, it was dark, and for a confused second she thought she was back at Haven. She could smell dinner cooking in the stew pot and hear the nurses move between the cots, talking to one another. Then she opened her eyes and remembered. Someone had shut the bedroom door, but a wedge of light showed from the living room. Jake and Gemma were talking in low voices, and something was cooking. The smell brought sudden tears to Lyra's eyes. She was starving, hungrier than she'd been in weeks. She eased out of bed, careful not to wake 72. She was vaguely disappointed to see they'd been sleeping with several feet of space between them. In her dream, they had been entangled again, sweating and shivering in each other's arms. In her dream, he'd said her name again, but into her mouth, whispering it. In the big room, Jake was bent over a computer laptop that sat next to a soda on the coffee table. He smiled briefly at Lyra. She was startled. It had been a long time since anyone had smiled at her, probably since Dr. O'Donnell, and she tried to smile back, but her cheeks felt sore and wouldn't work properly. It didn't matter, she was too late. He'd already turned his attention back to the computer. Immediately, Gemma was moving away from the stove with a bowl, skirting the table that divided the kitchen from the library. Lyra thought it must be called the library, anyway, since Dr. O'Donnell had told her that libraries were places you could read books for free.
"Here," Gemma said.
"Chili. From a can. Sorry," she added when Lyra stared.
"I can't cook."
But Lyra had only been wondering at all her freedoms, at the fact that Gemma knew how to shop and get food and clothing. Wherever she'd been made, she must have lived for most of her life among real people.
"You need to eat," Gemma said firmly, and seemed surprised and pleased when Lyra took the bowl and spoon and began to eat so quickly she burned the roof of her mouth.
She didn't even bother sitting down, both thrilled and disturbed by the fact that there was no one to yell at her or tell her to keep her seat. "Transmissible spongiform encephalopathies," Jake said out loud, still bending over his computer. "That's a category of disease. Mad cow is a TSE.
"Okay," Gemma drew out the last syllable, "but what does that mean?"
She went to sit next to Jake on the couch, and Lyra licked the bowl clean after making sure neither of them was looking. Jake kept turning his soda can, adjusting it so that the small, square napkin beneath it was parallel to the table's edge.
"I don't know."
Jake scrubbed his forehead with a hand and fixed his laptop so this, too, was parallel. "There are just references to it in the report." Lyra saw that next to Jake's computer was the file she'd stolen from Haven. She set her bowl down on the table with a clatter.
You shouldn't be looking at that,"
she said.
Why not?
Jake raised an eyebrow. You stole it, didn't you? Yes, Lyra said evenly, but that's different.
It's not like they'll miss it now. The whole place is an ash heap.
In Lyra's head, she saw all of Haven reduced to a column of smoke. Sometimes the bodies that burned came back to Haven in the form of smoke, in a sweet smell that tickled the back of the throat. The nurses hated it, but Lyra didn't. Jake, Chema said. He shrugged.
Sorry, but it's true.
He was right, obviously. She couldn't possibly get in trouble now for stealing the file or allowing someone else to see it, at least no more trouble than she was already in. Jake went back to thumping away at the computer. Chema reached out and drew the file onto her lap. Lyra watched her puzzle over it, frowning. Maybe Chema couldn't read. But after a minute, Chema said, Lyra, do you know what this means? It says the patient, the replica, I mean. She looked up as though for approval and Lyra nodded. Was in the yellow cluster? The yellow cluster. The saddest cluster of all. Lyra remembered all those tiny corpses with their miniature yellow bracelets, all of them laid out for garbage collection. The nurses had come through wearing gloves and masks that made them look like insects, double-wrapping the bodies, disposing of them. The yellows died, she said, and Chema flinched. There were about 100 of them, all from the younger crops. Crops, she went on when Chema still looked confused. Separate the different generations, but colors are for clusters. So, I'm third crop. Green cluster. She held up her bracelet where everything was printed neatly. Gen 3, TG-GR. Generation 3, testing group green. She didn't understand why Chema looked sick to her stomach. They must have made a mistake with the yellows. Sometimes they did that, made mistakes. The pinks died too.
They all died?
Jake asked. Lyra nodded. They got sick. Oh, my God. Chema brought a hand to her mouth. She seemed sad, which Lyra didn't understand. Chema didn't know anyone in the yellow cluster, and they were just replicas. It says here she was only 14 months. Lyra almost pointed out that the youngest had died when she was only 3 or 4 months, but didn't.
You said colors are for clusters, Jake said slowly, but clusters of what?
Lyra shrugged. There are different clusters, and we all get different variants.
Variants of what?
He pressed. Lyra didn't know exactly, but she wasn't going to admit it.
Medicine, she said firmly, hoping he wouldn't ask her anything more.
Chema sucked in a deep breath.
Look, Jake, it's signed by Dr. Saperstein, just like you said. Dr. Saperstein is in charge of the growth of new crops of replicas, Lyra said. Despite the fact that she was still annoyed at Jake and Chema for looking at the file, the private file, her file, she moved closer to the couch, curious to know what they were doing.
He signs all the death certificates.
Beneath his was a second signature, a name she knew well. Nurse M had been one of the nicer ones. Nurse M had taken care when inserting the needles to make sure it wouldn't hurt. She had sometimes told jokes. Nurse M signed too.
Nurse M.
Chema closed her eyes and leaned back.
Holy shit,
Jake said, and Chema opened her eyes again, giving Jake a look Lyra couldn't decipher. Nurse M was one of the nicest ones.
But she left, Lyra said. An old memory surfaced. She was alone in a hallway watching Dr. O'Donnell and Nurse M through a narrow crack in a door. Dr. O'Donnell had her hands on Nurse M's shoulders, and Nurse M was crying.
Think of what's right, Emily, Dr. O'Donnell said. You're a good person. You were just in over your head.
But then Nurse M had wrenched away from her, knocking over a mop, and Lyra had backed quickly away from the door before Nurse M barreled through it. But that couldn't have been a real memory. She remembered a janitor's closet, but that couldn't be right, not when the nurses and doctors had break rooms.
and Nurse M had been crying, but why would Dr. O'Donnell have made Nurse M cry?
Let me see that.
Jake took the file from Gemma and leaned over the computer again. Lyra liked watching the impression of his fingers on the keys, the way a stream of letters appeared as though by magic on the screen, far too fast for her to read. Click, click, click. The screen was now full of tiny type, photographs, diagrams. It was dizzying. She couldn't even tell one letter from another. This report, all of this terminology, TSEs and neural decay and protein folding, it's all about prions.
Prions?
Gemma said. She'd clearly never heard the word before, and Lyra was glad that for once she wasn't the one who was confused. Bacteria, viruses, fungi, and prions, Jake said, squinting at the screen. Prions are infectious particles. They're proteins, basically, except they're folded all wrong.
Replicas are full of prions, Lyra said, proud of herself for knowing this. The doctors had never said so directly, but she had paid attention.
At Haven, there was very little to do but listen. That was the purpose of the spinal taps and all the harvesting, to remove tissue samples to test for prion penetration. Often, when replicas died, they were dissected, their bones drilled open for the same reason. She knew that prions were incredibly important. Dr. Saperstein was always talking about engineering prions to be better and faster acting, but she didn't know what they were exactly. Jake gave her a funny look, as if he had swallowed a bad-tasting medicine.
I still don't get it, Gemma said. What do prions do?
He read out loud.
Prion infectivity is present at high levels in brain or other central nervous system tissues, and at slightly lower levels in the spleen, lymph nodes, bone marrow.
Wait, that's not it. If a prion enters a healthy organism, it induces existing, properly folded proteins to convert into the disease-associated, misfolded prion form.
In that sense, they are like cloning devices. He looked up at Gemma and then looked quickly down again.
The prion acts as a template to guide the misfolding of more proteins into prion form, leading to an exponential increase of prions in the central nervous system and subsequent symptoms of prion disease. This can take months or even years.
He put a hand through his hair again, and Lyra watched it fall, wondering whether 72's hair would grow out now, whether it would fall just the same way.
Prion disease is spread when a person or animal ingests infected tissue, as in the case of bovine SE or mad cow disease. Prions may also contaminate the water supply, given the presence of blood or other secretions.
So, prions are a kind of disease?
Gemma asked.
The bad kind of prions are disease, Jake said quietly.
That can't be right, Lyra said. She was having trouble following everything that Jake was saying, but she knew that there, at least, he was wrong. She knew that replicas were physically inferior to normal humans. The cloning process was still imperfect, and they were vulnerable. That was the word the doctors and nurses always used when they lined up vitamins and pills, sometimes a dozen in a row. But she'd always thought, and she didn't know why she'd thought this, but she knew it had to do with things overheard, sensed, and implied, that prions were good. She'd always had the impression that this was a single way in which replicas were superior to humans. Their tissue was humming with prions that could be extracted from them. She felt a curious tickle at the back of her throat, almost as if she had to sneeze. Sweat prickled in her armpits. Jake wouldn't look at her. She was used to that.
Listen to this.
Jake had pulled up new writing. So many lines of text, Lyra felt vaguely suffocated. How many words could there possibly be?
Google Saperstein and prions, and an article comes up from back in the early 1990s. Saperstein was speaking at a conference about biological terrorism. Chemical weapons and viral and bacterial agents are problematic. Our soldiers risk exposure even as the weapons are deployed against our enemies. War is changing. Our enemies are changing, growing radicalized and more diverse. I believe the future of biological warfare lies in the isolation of a faster-acting prion that can be distributed via food supply chains.
Jake was sweating, and Lyra had been sweating too, but now she was cold all over. It felt like she had to use the bathroom, but she couldn't move.
We might cripple terrorist groups by disseminating doctored medications and vaccinations, which will be unknowingly spread by healthcare workers in dangerous and remote environments immune to normal modes of attack. All known prion diseases in mammals affect the structure of the brain or other neural tissue, and all are currently untreatable and universally fatal. Imagine, Jake was barely whispering, terrorist cells or enemy insurgents unable to think, walk, or speak, paralyzed, or exterminated.
Oh my God, Gemma said. She brought a hand to her lips. That's awful.
From nowhere, a vision came to Lyra of a vast, dust-filled field and thousands of bodies wrapped in dark paper like the yellows had been, still and silent under a pale blue sky.
What was it that Jake had read?
All known prion diseases in mammals are currently untreatable and universally fatal.
Jesus.
Jake leaned back and closed his eyes. For a long time, no one said anything. Lyra felt strangely as if she had left her body behind, as if she no longer existed at all. She was a wall. She was the floor and the ceiling. That's the answer to what they were doing at Haven. Although he'd addressed Gemma, when he opened his eyes again, he looked directly at Lyra, and immediately she slammed back into her body and hated him for it. Prions live in human tissue. Don't you see? Lyra could see, but she couldn't say so. Her voice had dried up. She was filled with misfolded crystals, like tiny slivers of glass, slowly cutting her open from the inside. It was Gemma who spoke.
They've been experimenting on the replicas, she said slowly.
She wouldn't look at Lyra.
They've been observing the effects of the disease.
Not just experimenting on them, Jake said, and his voice broke.
Incubating them. Gemma, they've been using the replicas to make prions. They've been growing the disease inside them.
Lyra, Chapter 11.
I told you.
Lyra turned and saw 72, his cheeks still crisscrossed with lines from the pillow. He was looking not at Jake or Gemma, but directly at Lyra, and she couldn't read his expression. She had spent her whole life listening to doctors talk about the workings of the lungs and liver, the blood-brain barrier, and white blood cell counts, but she had never heard a single one explain how faces worked, what they meant, how to read them.
I told you,
he said again, softer this time.
They never cared. They were never trying to protect us. It was a lie.
You knew? She said.
He stared at her. Didn't you?
His voice was quiet.
Didn't you, really?
She looked away, ashamed. He was right, of course. Everything had fallen away, the final veil, the game she'd been playing for years, the lies she'd been telling herself. It all made sense now. Numbers instead of names, it instead of she or he.
Are you going to teach the rats to play chess?
They were disposable and always had been. It wasn't that they were more prone to diseases, to failures of the liver and lungs. They'd been manufactured to die.
All the times she felt nauseous or dizzy or couldn't remember where she was or where she was going, not side effects of the treatment, but of the disease.
Actually, not side effects at all. Symptoms.
Gemma stood up.
We've done enough for the night,
she said to Jake. Lyra knew that Gemma must feel sorry for them, or maybe she was only scared. Maybe she thought the disease was contagious. She wondered how long she had. 6 months? A year? It seemed so stupid to have run. What was the point, since she was just going to die anyway? Maybe she should have let the guards shoot her after all. Jake closed his computer.
It's after 10 o'clock, he said, rubbing his eyes. My aunt's coming back from Decatur tomorrow. I've got to go home.
Let's pick up in the morning, okay? We'll figure out what to do in the morning.
Gemma addressed the words to Jake, but Lyra had a feeling she meant the words for her.
Are you going to be okay?
Jake asked.
He lifted a hand as if he was going to touch Lyra's shoulder, but she took a quick step backward and he let his hand fall.
Lyra shrugged.
It hardly mattered.
She kept thinking about what Jake had said. They've been growing the disease inside them.
Like the glass hothouses where Haven grew vegetables and fruit. She pictured her body blown full of air and proteins misfolded into snowflake shapes. She pictured the illustration she'd once seen of a pregnant woman and the child curled inside her womb. They had implanted her. She was carrying an alien child, something deadly and untreatable.
If you need anything, just give a shout, Gemma said.
Here. Jake bent over and scrawled something on a piece of paper. Normally, Lyra loved to see a person writing by hand the way the letters simply fell from the pen, but now she didn't care. There was no help Jake could give her. No help anyone could give her.
This is my telephone number. Have you used a telephone before?
I know what a telephone is,
Lyra said. Though she had never used one herself, the nurses hardly did anything but. And as a little kid, she'd sometimes picked up random things, tubes of toothpaste, bars of soap, prescription bottles, and pretended to speak into them. Pretended there was someone in another world who would answer.
Jake nodded.
This is my address. Here, just in case. Can you read this?
Lyra nodded but couldn't bring herself to meet Jake's eyes.
For several minutes after Gemma and Jake left, Lyra stayed where she was, sitting on the couch. 72 moved around the room silently, picking things up and then putting them down. She was unaccountably angry at him. He had predicted this. That meant it was his fault.
When did you know?
She asked.
How did you know?
He glanced at her and then turned his attention back to a small bubble of glass. Plastic snow swirled down when he inverted it.
I told you. I didn't know exactly, he said, but I knew they were making us sick.
I knew that was the point. He said it casually.
How?
Lyra repeated. He set the snow globe down and Lyra watched a flurry of artificial snow swirl down on the two tiny figures contained forever in their tiny bubble world, a stretch of plastic beach, a single palm tree. She felt sorry for them. She understood them.
I didn't ever not know, he said, frowning.
To her surprise, he came to sit next to her on the couch. He still smelled good. This made her ache for some reason, as if inside of her someone was driving home a nail.
I was sick once, as a little kid. Very sick. I remember they thought I was going to die. I went to the funeral home.
He looked down at his hands.
They were excited. When they thought I couldn't understand them anymore, they were excited.
Lyra said nothing. She thought of lying on the table after seeing Mr. I, the happy chatter of the researchers above her, their sandwich-smelling breath and the way they laughed when her eyes refused to follow their penlight.
When I was a kid, I used to pretend, he said. I would pretend I was an ant or a lizard or a bird, anything else. I would catch roaches sometimes coming out of the drains. All the nurses hated the roaches, but even they were better off than we were. They could get out.
He opened his palm, staring as if he didn't recognize it, then closed it again in a fist.
It would be better, he said slightly louder, if they'd hated us. But they didn't.
About this, too, he was right.
Worse than nurse, don't even think about it. Worse than the ones who were afraid were the ones who hardly noticed. Who would look not at the replicas, but through them. Who could talk about what to eat for dinner, even as they bundled up dead bodies for burning.
Why didn't you tell me?
Lyra asked.
I tried, he said. Besides, what good would it do?
She shook her head. She needed someone to blame. She had never been so angry before. She hadn't even thought she had the right. People, real people, believed they deserved things and were angry when they didn't get them. Replicas deserved nothing, received nothing, and so were never angry. What kind of God was it, she wondered, who made people who would do what they had done to her? Is that why you ran away? Lyra asked. She felt like crying. She wasn't in physical pain, and yet she felt as if something had changed in her body, as if someone had put tubes in her chest and everything was entangled.
No, 72 said, not exactly.
Why, then? He just shook his head. She doubted whether he knew himself. Maybe only for a change? Then he said,
we can't stay here, you know.
Lyra hadn't expected this. Why not?
We're not safe here,
he said, and his expression turned again, folded up.
I told you. I don't trust them. They aren't replicas.
The girl is, Lyra said. He frowned.
She doesn't know it, he said. No one's told her.
But we don't have anywhere else to go, she said, and once again realized how true it was. How big was the world? She had no idea. They'd driven for what felt like hours today, and there had been no end to the roads and shopping complexes, streets and houses. And yet Gemma had told her they were still in Florida. How much farther did it all go on? Besides, what does it matter?
We'll just die anyway, she almost added, but she knew he understood. I didn't come this far to be a toy, he said. I could have gone back to Haven for that.
Lyra didn't know what he meant exactly, but she could guess from his tone of voice. They've been good to us, she said. They helped us. They fed us. They gave us clothes and somewhere to sleep.
Exactly. So what do they want? They must want something. They're people, he said. That's what they do, don't you see? That's all they ever do. They want.
Was that true? She didn't know. What had Dr. O'Donnell wanted from her, or Nurse M, who always smiled at the replicas, who had once told Lyra she had pretty eyes, who saved up her old fairy tokens to give to the young kids to play checkers with? But maybe that was why they had left Haven. They did not fit in. She still didn't understand what made people so different from replicas, had never been able to understand it. And she had wanted things, too, in her life. She had wanted to learn to read. She had been hungry, cold, and tired, and wanted food and her bed, but it was true. She had never hurt anyone to get what she wanted. Was that what made her less than human?
Is that enough for you?
72 said. He scared her when he looked this way, and reminded her of the statue in the courtyard at Haven, whose face, deformed by rain, was sightless and cold.
Someone to feed you, and order you around, tell you when to sleep, like a dog?
She stood.
Well, what's the difference?
She said, and she could tell she'd surprised him because he flinched. She was surprised, too. Her voice was much louder than she'd expected. We're replicas, aren't we?
We might as well be dogs. That's how they think of us anyway. That's what we were made for, to be dogs or rats. You weren't pretending all those years ago. You were a roach.
He stared at her for a long second. She could see his chest rising with his breath and knew that beneath his skin, hundreds of tiny muscles were contracting in his face, even to hold it there, still, watching her. The idea of him and what he was made of, all the different fragile parts spun together, made her dizzy. Finally, he looked away.
That's why I ran, he said.
I wanted to know whether we could be good for anything else.
I wanted to try.
To her surprise, he smiled just a little.
Besides, even roaches run away. Rats, too.
They went through the guest house looking for anything that would be useful. In a bedroom closet beneath extra pillows, they found an old backpack, which they filled with the remaining granola bars and bottles of water, plus the bathroom things that Gemma had bought for them. Lyra knew they likely wouldn't need soap, but couldn't stand to leave the pretty paper-wrapped bars behind, so different from anything she'd ever owned. Jake had left his cell phone charging in the corner and 72 took it, although they had no one to call. It excited Lyra to have it in their possession, to touch the screen and leave fingerprints there. Only people had cell phones. They took knives from the kitchen, a blanket from the otherwise empty cabinet by the bed. She didn't feel guilty about stealing from Jake and Gemma, who had helped them. She felt nothing at all. Maybe, she thought, the nurses had been right about replicas. Maybe they didn't have souls. By then, the main house had gone dark. 72 suggested they turn the light off, too. So in case Jake and Gemma were looking out for them, they would believe Lyra and 72 had gone to bed. They waited there, in the dark, for another 20 minutes, just to be sure. They sat again on the sofa side by side, and Lyra thought of her dream of entanglement, all those inches and inches of exposed skin. She was glad he couldn't see her. Finally, he touched her elbow. "It's time," he said. His face in the dark was different colors of shadow. Outside, the sound of insects and tree frogs startled Lyra, a rhythmic and almost mechanical thrumming that recalled the throaty roar of Mr. I. "Wait." 72 nudged her. Gemma was curled up on a plastic deck chair, still wearing her clothes, using several colorful towels as blankets. Lyra was confused. Had she been watching them, trying to make sure they didn't escape? She couldn't imagine why she would have otherwise chosen to sleep outside. Before she could stop him, 72 was already moving closer, stepping very carefully. Lyra followed him with a growing sense of unease. Gemma's face in the moonlight looked so much like Cassiopeia's, she wanted to reach out and lay a hand on Gemma's chest, to feel her breathing and believe Cassiopeia had come back to life. But she didn't, obviously. Lying next to Gemma on the pool deck was an open notebook. A pen had rolled into the binding. As always, Lyra was drawn to the words, scribbled across the page. They appeared to glow faintly in the moonlight. Gemma's writing, she thought, was very beautiful. The words reminded her of bird tracks, of birds themselves, pecking their way proudly across the page. Then a familiar name caught her attention.
Emily Huang.
Nurse M. She placed a finger on the page, mouthing the words written directly beneath the name, Palm Grove. The words meant nothing to her. There were other names on the page, all of them unfamiliar except for Dr. Saperstein's, which was joined by a small notation to the Home Foundation. She didn't know what that was, either, but beneath it was at last another word she recognized. Gainesville. This, she knew, was a place, a big place. Jake and Gemma had argued about whether they should be getting off at the highway exit to Gainesville, and Jake had said, "No one wants to go to Gainesville." And then Gemma had said, "Except the 500,000 people who live there." She figured that Palm Grove might be a place, too. She took the notebook. Jake had taken the file folder she'd stolen, so it was a fair trade. She straightened up and saw that 72 was rifling through Gemma's bag to get to her wallet. She grabbed his shoulder, shaking her head. Once, years ago, don't even think about it, its wallet had been stolen from the mess hall, and she remembered how terrible it was, how all the replicas' beds were searched and their cubbies turned out, how don't even think about it was in a foul mood for days and backhanded Lyra for looking at her wrong. They had found it, finally, in a hole torn out of the underside of Ursa Major's mattress, along with all the other things she'd scavenged over the years. Dirty socks and a lost earring, fairy tokens, soda can tabs, gum wrappers. But she couldn't speak without risking waking Gemma, and even as she watched, he removed a wedge of money from her wallet, and pocketing it, returned the wallet to her purse. Lyra put back the notebook anyway. She wasn't likely to forget Palm Grove. They scaled the gate because they didn't know how to make it work, and once they were on the other side, on a street made liquid dark and shiny by the streetlights, began to walk. Bound on either side by houses with their hedges and gates, Lyra did not feel so afraid. But soon they reached a road that stretched blackly into the empty countryside, and she felt a kind of terror she associated with falling. So much space. More space than she'd ever imagined. Only then did Lyra speak. They'd gone too far to be heard by anyone. Besides, she hated the emptiness of the road and the street lamps bent silently over their work, like tall arms planted in the earth. "I know someone who can help us," she said. Their feet crunched on the gravel at the side of the road. Now she was grateful for the tree frogs. At least they were company.
Help us.
72 tilted his head back to look at the sky and the stars spread above them. She couldn't tell whether he was frightened, but she doubted it. He didn't seem afraid of anything, even dying. Maybe he just had time to get used to it. She had known that replicas were frailer than real people, more prone to illness, sicklier and smaller, but on some level she'd believed that at Haven, she might be safe.
I want to know more.